together for this perspective?
First of all, I want to thank the organizers for letting an outsider like me come to this workshop. It has been a lot of fun. It has been a lot of fun learning what string theorists are thinking about. So my charge is to tell you something about our universe. I want to...
Which part of it?
Our very local universe. So I thought I would put together a few things. They are not, they are somewhat related, but they fall into a little bit disjoint topics. But a few things that I've been working on that might be of interest to you. One is this issue of whether the spectral index is running. And to talk about that, I will actually talk about something about Limehouse Forest, because any evidence we have so far, currently, for a running spectral index actually comes from combining large-scale fluctuations from CNB with small-scale information from the Limehouse Forest. So I need to talk a little bit about that. And then that will probably be the first half of my talk. And then in the second half, I'll talk a little bit about this issue that arises from one of the MAP papers, WMAP papers, is lambda 5 to the fourth quadratic potential rule out. And that has something to do with the issue of number of EFOs. And at the end, if I have time, I'll say a few words about gravity waves. And along the way, I would like to make a few comments about things to keep in mind as you think about cosmology from a string theory perspective. So first, one thing I want to stress is that it's probably widely known already, is that in terms of thinking about a power spectrum, this is just a plot of the power spectrum as a function of scale, let's say today. CNB is not the whole story. The reason is that if you look at a map like this, a plot like this, you can see that basically different observations probe different scales. The larger scales, that's what CNB is good for. And then you have galaxy surveys or lensing at intermediate scales, Limehouse Forest at the smaller scales, about 1 megaparsec moving. And naturally, if you really want to measure the power spectrum as accurately as possible, in particular, you want to see how accurate you can measure the spectral index and if there's any running, a large range in scales is favorable, naturally. The larger the range in scales, the better a chance you have to actually measure the primordial power spectrum accurately.
See, but doesn't it cover like 3 decades because you have L from 1 to 1,000, or is that not for everything, right?
It's roughly so. So from L of let's say a few to L of 1,000.
So the cutoff there is like L of 1,000. That's sort of where CFB ends.
If you go all the way to let's say 3,000 or something like that, it would actually extend for a little bit further. But on smaller scales, beyond about 1,000, the interpretation of CNB becomes more complicated. Some of the fluctuations actually arise not from actually the last scattering, but from actually late universe physics. But of course, as you all know, the CNB is nice because the physics is relatively simple, so the interpretation is unambiguous. Before I go on and talk about Limehouse Forest, I just want to make one more point, which is related to the discussion recently we had, which is that another thing to keep in mind is that your favorite theory, whatever your theory is, might have large-scale structural implications, and it's good to keep that in mind as a means to test your theory. For example, these are examples that came up in the discussion last week, right? For example, we have this picture of multiple vacua in string theory, and last week it came up, which kind of picture is it? Is it more like a staircase, or is it more something like this? And they certainly would have different large-scale structural implications. For example, a universe like this, where we live in one of these minima, is very likely that the last nucleation event in our universe would come from basically nucleating from a vacuum, which is actually very closely spaced in terms of energy to us. Something like this might create a very inhomogeneous universe, for example, depending on how you choose your parameters. Something like this, on the other hand, would not. And secondly, mentioned a little bit in Sean's talk last week, that proposals that modify gravity on large scales would also naturally modify how structure grows. So this is something to keep in mind. So let me go to the topic of running, right? So what is meant by running is just something very simple. So if you say the power spectrum, the primordial power spectrum, not the one I showed you before, which is the power spectrum today, the primordial power spectrum is parameterized by a power law, roughly scale invariant, NS spectral index close to 1. But you can imagine that, you know, if you just Taylor series expand, there could be terms coming to the next order, which tells you the spectral index might actually be a function of scale.
May I ask a simple question? I mean, do we have to parameterize the power spectrum that way to fit the data, or could we just fit the data and measure P of K?
You can actually measure just the band power P of K without using a model like this.
Okay. Why people always give the result?
Because you're it's an issue of number of parameters. With this, with a single power law, you have just one parameter. If you have several band powers, you have many more parameters. Each of them would be, the measurement would be more noisy. But it's in principle possible, yes. Especially, you know, if there are features in the power spectrum that you want to look for.
But there's no significant evidence for deviation from the power.
That's right. Observationally, a power law is not a bad, it's not a bad fit to the data.
This is the primordial spectrum. So
this is the primordial.
It doesn't extend into the Lyman forest region.
Well, it does. It should extend everywhere.
So NS would really be quite different from the
No, the primordial power spectrum is still of this form. What we observe, of course, is a process. Is after processing. Yes. Yes, but the parameter of theoretical interest, at least, is this one, right? Mm-hmm. Is this the primordial index?
But all these things you're trying to use, they're in the linear regime, right? So if you change the primordial power spectrum, you simply change the entropy. Correct.
What you would change, for example, what you would change in a plot like this, if you add a tilt to the primordial power spectrum, you would basically tilt this whole thing.
Right, well, I'm just saying that
for
if
the linear
I add aspect. Any single bump or wiggle to that, to the primordial power spectrum,
yes.
It shows up exactly as an equivalent bump or wiggle
yes.
In the final answer.
Yes.
Yeah. Everything is a linear curve.
So let me summarize the current evidence basically from this paper for running, right? So if you look at just WMAP data alone, these are the constraints on the spectral index and the running dn d log k, where the pivot scale is basically given by this. From WMAP alone, you can see certainly NS is consistent with 1, and any evidence for running is pretty weak. It's about 1 sigma. These are 1 sigma, yes. And so to get better constraint, what the WMAP team did was to combine WMAP data with actually also smaller scale CMB experiments and other things like the 2DF galaxy surveys and then the Lyman forest. At best, the evidence for running is about 2 sigma. It's a negative, about 2 sigma evidence for negative running. In other words, there's a tendency for a red tilt at smaller scales, but it's at best 2 sigma.
But sorry, the tilt, what we call the tilt is just a measurement of NS.
Yes,
if it's 1, then it's untilted.
Right.
And less than 1 is red?
Less than 1 is red. So basically, the data suggests that you want a little bit less power on small scale than you would have expected from just a power law extrapolation. Okay, so that's before I talk about what, yeah.
That seems a little strange because 0.03 sounds like a small DNS DLK, but over a fairly large number of decades, that can have a huge cumulative effect.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
It seems to be consistent with the fact that it's like so close to 1.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's in fact what I want to say in the next transparency. So it's a cautionary note. You know, if running is large, the whole expansion is suspect, you know. Basically, this expansion where you just stop at the first derivative, it might be just might be suspect. I mean, the simplest way to think about it is just as Joe said, I mean, for this expansion to be valid at all, you want this to be much bigger than the first derivative term. And if this is 0.03, the range in scales is about a couple, then this would basically break down. Another way to say the same thing is that the deviation of the spectrum from scale invariance, at least in simple inflation models, goes like basically V prime over V square or V double prime over V, where V is the inverton potential. Whereas the running goes like basically at least the triple derivative. And the usual assumption, it doesn't have to be true, but the usual assumption is to say, well, these are small, the running goes like ns minus 1 square. It doesn't have to be true, but for a lot of models, it is true. And so if the running is actually indeed as large as this, this kind of expansion is also somewhat suspect. How do you truncate?
Where does that last equation come from? Just for class of V, this is true?
Yeah, for example, the usual polynomial inverton potential, chaotic inflation, this would be true. Okay, so after this note, let me actually turn to the subject of the Lyman of Forest. What we can learn from it and some ongoing work from the Sloan survey. So this is what a spectrum of a quasar looks like at high redshift. This is the Lyman alpha emission line. This is Lyman beta, and so on. You can see these emission lines of the Lyman series from hydrogen in the quasar. The rest frame wavelength of Lyman alpha is 1216 angstrom. So the fact that you see this line at 6,000 or so means this is highly redshifted. The way to think about this is you have basically photons of different energy emitted from the quasar, and let's say look at a photon with a somewhat longer wavelength. Then, as it travels towards the observer, it gets redshifted. The wavelength becomes longer. At some point, it reaches resonance 1216 angstroms, and there will be some probability of absorption depending on how much hydrogen there is at that point. For another photon that has a somewhat shorter wavelength, it has to experience longer periods of redshift. And so that photon would get absorbed here. And so you can imagine looking at a spectrum like this, it gives you basically a view of fluctuation in the universe, a one-dimensional view of fluctuation in the universe as a function of position or redshift. The physics is very simple. Just want to emphasize, basically what you observe, the flux is goes like e to the minus tau, where tau is the optical depth. You just integrate the hydrogen along the left side with the Lyman alpha cross section. And roughly speaking, more or less, you can think of the optical depth as basically a map of the density. It goes like density square. It's basically because of ionization equilibrium. And the program to carry out is basically to do the following. You can measure the power spectrum of the flux, of the observed flux, or e to the minus tau. And then you try to infer the mass power spectrum of the density, of the mass density from it. So roughly speaking, that's the program.
So
yeah.
This is caused by hydrogen clouds.
Yes, yes.
So this rho is the density of baryons.
Yes. That's right. So at least in the simplest picture, the belief is that on large scales, the gas should just trace the dark matter. So these are mildly nonlinear fluctuations. On small scales, because you're not looking at dark matter directly, this would be smooth compared to the dark matter fluctuation, basically because of gene smoothing. So these are things that have to be accounted for. So what I want to do in the next 15 minutes or so is to talk about ongoing work from actually a data set from the Sloan survey. And I just want to start by saying this is the work of a lot of people. In particular, I want to highlight the contribution of Scott Burrows at MIT and Adam Litz, a student from Columbia University. And to show you roughly what is the size of the sample, I just basically make a plot of the number of lines of sight as a function of absorption redshift. I just spin it up into 10 bins or so. You can roughly see basically we have a lot of lines of sight at lower redshift, between 2 to 3, and then we see certainly fewer and fewer quasars as you go to a high redshift. Altogether, there are about 3,000 lines of sight. And each of the quasar spectrum looks something like this. Certainly looks nothing like the classic textbook example that I show you. Number one, because the resolution is lower in the Sloan survey, is about 100 kilometers per second, and it's noisier. The Limehouse Forest is just this region between here and here. This is the region that we are studying. One of the issues, it's probably better to illustrate using this, because you can see it more clearly. One of the issues one has to contend with is the fact that when you see fluctuations here, a priori, you don't actually know whether the fluctuation you see is because of fluctuation in the absorption, which is what you're interested in, or just a variation in the intrinsic spectrum, the original spectrum of the quasar, which people call the continuum. And so certainly, especially if you want to measure the large scale power, the continuum is believed to be smooth. And so if you want to measure the large scale power, you have to know what the continuum is. And so one thing the Sloan data set is very good for is, because of the large number of line of sight, what you can do is you can basically shift all the quasar spectrum to the same redshift and just take the average of the spectrum. When you take the average, the forest would just disappear, basically because you don't get many different lines of sight, random faces. What you see left is basically the true continuum, that is the average continuum of the quasars.
So can that be calculated theoretically?
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard. Yeah, people will try to predict spectrum of quasars. Well, Omer is an expert. I don't know if Omer is here. But it's very hard. I think Omer would agree.
Your average year of any lines is that an absorption, so isn't that lower than the spectrum?
It would lower the... So the fact that this side appears to be a little bit lower than that side, that is because of absorption. Yes. But what we are interested in is basically the fluctuation of the absorption around the mean. So the overall normalization doesn't really matter. So I'm going to skip a lot of details. Show you one plot. This is the measurement of the power spectrum, not the power spectrum that you are interested in yet. It's just the flux power spectrum, one-dimensional, as a function of scale at three different redshifts. Just look at the color lines, just to give you a sense of. This is basically the input. So this is what we measure from the data. And from this, we want to infer something about the primordial power spectrum. And of course, it's very complicated, right? So one complication, of course, is what you measure is the one-dimensional power spectrum. What you're interested in, the three-dimensional power spectrum. And there are also other issues, which let me hold off on that and just give you what we found.
Can I ask the growth match what you expected from theory?
I'm going to show a plot of that in a few of graphs. That's a very good question. So the constraint we get just from the Limehouse Forest, one way to parametrize this is to say, basically, the Limehouse Forest is only sensitive to the power on a pretty narrow range in scales, around 1 to 10 co-moving megaparsec. So one way to characterize what the forest by itself tells you is basically the spectral index at the scale that the forest is sensitive to, which is basically this scale, and the amplitude of the power spectrum. This by itself probably doesn't make too much sense to you. The best thing is to actually map this onto the primordial power spectrum and tells you what we got. And this was done by Kev Abelsagen and Scott Dodson. What they did was they basically repeat the same exercise that the WMAP team did. So they took advantage of the large scale information from WMAP, combined that with the constraint that I just showed you from the Sloan survey from 3,000 lines of sight. And this is so far at least the current conclusion. It might still change with time for the scalar spectral index and the running, 1 and 2 sigma contours. As currently, we don't actually find evidence for running. In fact, it's consistent with the most boring universe imaginable, scale invariant. The most bland predictions of inflation.
So, yes. I'm going to talk about this later, but I know that Rocky likes to make the point that if you found that NS was not equal to 1, that would be the best evidence you will ever find in favor of inflation. Because if you're just comparing it to some unknown mechanism, it doesn't do anything.
Right,
it's
right.
People imagine that gets you exactly 1, but inflation gives you a natural way to get not quite 1.
Right, right, right.
So it's probably harder.
Yes, we are trying very hard. Yes, we are trying very hard. And in fact, if you set running to 0, that's some preference for red tilt. But it's still consistent with 1. So for NS less than 1.
That's 1 sigma, 2 sigma?
Yeah, that's 1 and 2 sigma contours. So it's, you know, it's certainly consistent with 1.
This looks different than the WMAP numbers you had at the beginning.
Yes, because this is using a larger data set for the Lyman River Forest.
Okay,
so the only difference, that's the change, yes.
And it shifted it quite a bit.
Yes, for the WMAP, there's a preference for negative running.
Yeah. Any chance it will shift again?
that's this is ongoing work, so this is not yet published yet. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the WMAP result by itself is only 2 sigma. Evidence for running.
It was minus 0.07, right? I mean, it was shifted.
No, the point from the government was a.
Right, sorry.
And it's
yeah.
Point,
yeah, they
point
are that.
Right.
But the derivative with WMAP was what?
0.03. Minus 0.03, sorry. Minus
0.03. You think with a small error? Or?
It's 2 sigma evidence for running. The error is like.
If your reanalysis, that error would underestimate the
previous error. The WMAP error.
Yeah.
This is the WMAP. So this is the. This is what you look. Yes. Yes.
That's
WMAP
with everything else.
W by itself.
It's just 1 sigma.
It's just 1 sigma. Yes.
And the plot, that was just the Sloan data, or that's also with
WMAP. Sloan WMAP with Sloan Lyman alpha, basically.
And
to the F.
Really?
No to the F.
Sam?
Yes.
This Seljak's group find the same result as you?
They find different results.
Okay.
So we are slowly converging. Yes.
Can you explain a little bit what goes into the estimation of the errors? Are they just statistical errors, or do you put in some more information?
So let me explain the details a little bit. So certainly that's statistical error just because of the finite sample and the short noise of the data. But there are actually other important sources of error. So one thing I should emphasize is this program of going from what you see, which is the fluctuation in the flux, to the mass power spectrum, which is the quantity of interest, it involves certain several what I call nuisance parameters that we are not interested in theoretically, at least for some people, that you have to basically marginalize over. I mean, we have some idea of what they are, but they contribute a lot to the error, like the temperature of the intergalactic medium, the I shouldn't call it equation of state, but it's basically how the density and the temperature are related for the gas and the ionizing background. And these are things that are not very well known. And so what we have to do is actually to fit the data with the parameters that we're interested in, which is in the power spectrum, and these at the same time, and then basically marginalize over these. And that contributes to a lot of the error, actually.
Thank you. assuming those are constant.
No, we do not assume those are those can vary with redshift.
But you assume something. You model the these parameters somehow, and that also goes into the I think that's what they do. You assume some specific form for the relationships, say for alpha, that it can be.
Yes. So the assumption is that the temperature as a function of density goes like a power law, and that power law is just basically this alpha. It doesn't have to be that way. We have some evidence, at least theoretical reason to believe that might be true for the low density in the galactic medium. But so these things actually contribute a lot to the error. To get to last question, one of the things that that you have to keep in mind is that the inference on the mass power spectrum makes one fundamental assumption, which is that the ionizing background, if it's spatially fluctuating, the amount of fluctuation on the scale that we are probing is small. Because let's say the ionizing background actually has a lot of fluctuations. What you observe is fluctuation in the neutral hydrogen. To go from neutral hydrogen to the gas density, we basically assume that fluctuations in the ionizing background is small. In other words, we basically assume it's uniform. And so we need consistency checks for this kind of methods. And I'm going to talk about two. One is this question of linear growth. Do we see, after we infer the mass power spectrum, does it grow in the right way that we expect from just gravity? The error bars are large, but you can see, at least with the current accuracy, is consistent. So let me explain this view graph a little bit. The red contour are 1 and 2 sigma contours by basically combining the whole data set. The blue contours is basically the constraints on the slope and amplitude at the corresponding redshifts. And what we have done to the red contour is to shift it according to basically linear growth. And so if it's truly just linear growth, this the blue contour and red contour should overlap. The error bars are large, but to the extent we can test this, it looks okay. Another important test is basically the following. If the fluctuations we see indeed just come from a gravitational instability, one expect, just by doing making simple arguments, that there should be a hierarchy of correlations. The three-point function should go like the two-point function square. Endpoint function should go like two-point function to the n minus 1 power. That's just come from looking at the fluctuation growth equations. And for Gaussian initial conditions, that's the hierarchy you should expect, and we should see that in the data. And one way to say the same thing is if you look at a plot of the this is just the one-point probability distribution of the flux as a function of flux. The histogram is basically the theoretical prediction. The solid triangle, the black triangle, is what you measured. Now, when you look at a probability distribution like this, what you're looking is not just the second moment. You're looking at actually the full distribution. In other words, you are looking at actually the second moment, third moment, fourth moment, and so on. And to the extent that the agreement is very good, it also where the theoretical predictions is of course just based on gravitational instability. To the extent the agreement is good, it also gives you support for the idea that the fluctuation you are seeing is truly the mass fluctuations that arise from gravity. The empty triangles is basically the data without correcting for the effect of the continuum. So this thing that I alluded to before, if you're not careful about the continuum, the fluctuation you see might actually not be fluctuation in the absorption, but just intrinsic variation in the quasar. After you correct for it, it seems to work pretty well.
Do you need a model?
Well, it's no, no. Well, at least you wouldn't want to. This is, for example, one way to do it, right? That I alluded to. So you basically figure out what is the continuum by basically shifting many quasars to the same redshift and averaging, and then you see the absorption basically disappears in the average, other than an overall offset. So I think that's let me just tell you about one more idea, and it has yet to be applied to more to the Sloan data, which is something like this. Imagine you look at a region of the universe with a fluctuation in density like this, right? This high density, this low density. And then you look at the small scale fluctuations symbolized by this this red wave. The fluctuation in this part of the universe would feel like it lives in a high omega matter universe. The fluctuation in this part, in this region, would feel like it lives in a low omega matter universe, and they would grow differently. And again, this would be a good test of this this whole picture of gravity, that the fluctuation you are seeing is indeed what you expect, basically from gravitational instability. It's actually not unrelated to this hierarchy of correlations that I alluded to before. So I think that's all I'm going to say about the Lyman-Hubbard forest.
No, this is
Sloan data. Probably something like a quarter of it, of the eventual total. Yes. Factor of two, right. The statistical error bar, yes. Yes. And in fact, the current error bar is we are actually pushing already to the limitation from these extra parameters that we don't actually know much about. So I'm going to switch subject and talk about this issue of whether the lambda phi fourth chaotic inflation, Andre's chaotic inflation, is that real or not. There was this paper. The author is actually in the audience. That ruled out basically this model by setting n. N is a number of EFO. I will return to a more proper definition of what is really this n. By setting that n equal to 50, and that's n at a particular scale, k of 0.02. And then later on, there were a few papers that came out that make the suggestion that this model would be consistent with data if n were large enough. And the question, so that's the motivation for this part of the talk. It's not necessarily because lambda phi to the fourth is the best model, depending on your point of view. But one can draw a few interesting lessons from it. So let me just start with some background. So these are things that I'm sure most of you know very well already. I just want to summarize here for our discussions. So the scalar power spectrum from inflation, at least for a single field inflation model, goes like basically h squared over epsilon. Epsilon is what is called the slow roll parameter. It goes like v prime over v squared. I'm just setting all the n prime to 1, right? The tensor power spectrum goes like h squared. The scalar spectral index is departure from scale invariance, goes like epsilon. It also depends on v double prime over v. The tensor spectral index goes like epsilon. The tensor to scalar ratio, again, goes like epsilon when you take the ratio of the two. What observations tells us is, of course, that ns minus 1 is small, and the tensor to scalar ratio is also small. Now, small is a relative term. This has to be about less than about 10% or so. R, depending on your definitions, the current limit on R is actually not that strong. This has to be less than about 1 or so. But we know we like the region of small departure from scale invariance. And certainly the data is consistent with no tensor fluctuations. To make this more concrete, let's look at the five-fold chaotic inflation model. This is a plot of the potential. And if you work out this small parameter, it goes like 1/5². And so to make your model consistent with observations, the natural thing to do is just to push phi to a large values, right? If you push phi to large values, you lower ns minus 1 and you lower the scalar, the tensor to scalar ratio. And so this naturally brings us to the question of number of e-folds. An alternative way of thinking about this is just you can just write down what is the expression for these two quantities as a function of number of e-folds n. And let me define n carefully. N is not the total number of e-folds during inflation. That, for this purpose, can be arbitrarily large. N here is just the number of e-folds from the time when your wave mode of interest exits the horizon to the end of inflation. So the cartoon to keep in mind is basically this cartoon in the bottom, where here I just plot basically the Hubble radius, h minus 1, as a function of the scale factor. And during inflation, it's pretty flat, and then it takes off after inflation ends. And the brown dotted line here is just the wavelength, the proper wavelength of a given wave mode. Let's say to make it definite, k of 0.02, which is what people often use. And so what is called n here is just the number of e-folds between the end of inflation and the horizon exit for that wave mode. And then you can imagine that something like this must be true. As you push away to a higher and higher n, you are basically going to a higher and higher phi. And so everything would go to that limit of scale invariant and very little tensor to scalar ratio. And the issue is, how high can you push n? And this is probably something that's pretty well known. Let me just show you a plot of what the observations constraints are. I took it from this paper, where what is shown is the same thing I defined before, the scalar spectral index, and this is the tensor to scalar ratio, 1, 2, 3 sigma contours. And so the data is certainly consistent with the boring point, which is no tensor and scale invariant. And what these authors show here is basically this point when you look at, let's say, lambda 5/4 model, as you increase n, you basically get closer and closer to this prediction. And so the question of whether a particular model is ruled out depends on, you know, how high n could be. You could make your data consistent by basically making n big enough. And so one way to think about this, and is a k of 0.002. So that is, one could pick any scale you want, of course.
Is that roughly the horizon size today?
No, it's a little bit smaller.
It's about L30?
Yes. In fact, it's picked to be 0.02 by Hiranyu. So, you know,
that one, is that the one that gives you the strongest constraints?
We picked that because, for the scale spectrum index, it's definitely not the one that gives the strongest constraints, but you have to evaluate the tensor mode at the same point against the scale mode. Because we define the tensor scale ratio as the ratio of the inequality rather than the quadruple ratio as often is done, because that was margin. So we thought this was a good number.
Have you tried other numbers?
We haven't tried it, but it's
it's just a way of parameterizing it. So you could pick any scale you want.
So you can make R arbitrarily small for multiple field models?
Yes. By going to earlier and earlier, pushing up higher and higher the potential, for example. So I want to make an argument that is probably pretty well known, which is the following.
Yeah.
Well, yes, please.
Larger in the model. You change lambda?
You change, no, you change phi. You push the
high,
you start higher and higher in the potential.
You may play a little bit with the length of inflation by playing, for example, something with a mechanism for heating, etc.
Right.
The length of time you expand after inflation is something model dependent.
Right.
Okay. So he said it is coupled to the reheat temperature? Is that what he said?
It is coupled. He's going to tell him.
Well, Andre already knows all the answers. So let's go back to this graph, right? So at least in the simplest picture, so you can think of the horizon or the Hubble scale basically is constant during inflation, and then afterwards, if it's radiation dominated, h minus one just goes like a square. And then you have this wave mode that you are interested in. You can pick any wave mode you want. The simplest choice would just to be take the wave mode of the largest scale you can actually observe, the horizon scale today. And how high could this n be? So one way to think about this is you can make n higher by basically pushing the energy scale of inflation to a higher energy scale. Just extend this curve instead of having inflation at this energy scale, you have a higher energy scale. Then you push n higher. However, we already know
that really means the energy scale to which you reheat in some sense, because it's how much of that a squared growth you have really matters.
Let me come back to the subtleties about reheating and things like that in a minute. So let me just make this the simplest argument here. Just look at this view graph. Then you can see that that n could be made higher by making the energy scale of inflation higher, but we already know that there are limits on the energy scale of inflation because the gravity wave background is very simply related to the energy scale of inflation. It's just h over n Planck, and we know that cannot be too large already. And just from that kind of argument, you will come back to these very familiar numbers. N of 60 cannot be larger than 60. There's a tilde here because it actually depends a little bit on exactly the model, which is what I'll come back to. But I just want to make the point for this particular model, 5/4 chaotic inflation, n has to be less than 62 under some assumptions. So let me come to the subtleties, right? The things that you can worry about. So let me just talk about two class of subtleties. Everything else basically belong to these two class. The first is that, of course, the energy, the Hubble, the horizon is not exactly constant during inflation. It could change. This line doesn't have to be flat. In fact, if you approach the limit where this is just marginally inflating, for example, you can certainly make n bigger. And that's where the model dependence comes in. So depending on a particular model, n has to be less than 60 plus some integral over this small parameter. So typically, it would change things by a few infolds, depending on your model. For lambda 5/4, is about this whole thing is about 2. The second subtlety that several people alluded to is basically the following: this bound assumes something about how the density redshifts after what I call inflation. So when I say the end of inflation, it basically it has a very exact meaning. It means basically epsilon basically is 1, goes to 1. So you are at the limit of just inflating. That's what is usually called the end of inflation. What happens after that would change this bound. For example, the way you would weaken the bound is to have the density redshift faster than radiation after inflation. Then you will weaken the bound, which is basically shown by this here. So let's say the blue line is the standard picture. The brown line is basically the density, the dominant density component, redshift faster than radiation after inflation, and so you can have a larger number of efforts. So you can weaken the bound that way. And the kind of complications that were mentioned, complications in reheating, change in degree of freedom, lay entropy production after inflation, those things usually go in the other way of actually strengthening the bound, right? Because usually what happens in these complications is that after the end of inflation, the density actually rises slower than radiation, so it actually strengthens the bound. But this caveat should be kept in mind about this bound of n less than 60 or so. You can certainly weaken it if you want to. For example, if you have a long period where the energy density is dominated by, let's say, the kinetic energy of a scalar field, then it would redshift faster than radiation.
Just out of curiosity, is there a lower limit on this number?
There are lower limits, but it's not very interesting from the point of view. So you certainly want n to be able to produce the observed large-scale structure. So the range in scales that we actually observe is about 10 to the 3, so it's 70 volts. So the most conservative thing, you can say, well, you probably want n to be larger than 7.
You would also like to solve the horizon and planet
problem. Yes, if in addition you want to solve those problems, then you would go.
And the usual story that you need 60 volts to solve
but,
the horizon
but,
problem.
But,
for
yes. That's right. But you should keep in mind. If you have late entropy
production, then you estimate can change. So why not have the equivalent of, let's say, 20 defaults in late entropy production? Do we know that this cannot happen?
Oh, it can certainly happen. But the things like those would basically actually make the bound stronger and not weaker.
So this is the end. In relation to this
Sean's question. Right. But what I thought was interesting, it's just an offhand comment. I don't see a way to make this actually sufficiently interesting to give constraints. But it's an interesting thought because in principle, this kind of argument tells you that we have some indirect observational handle on the history of the universe in this kind of the desert region between nucleosynthesis and inflation, because let's say you have some favorite model, and some favorite model for inflation. Presumably, that model would violate observations if n is too small. And if you have late entry production and things like that, you might actually make the bound sufficiently small that it will make it not viable. So it's kind of a convoluted argument, but it's an interesting thought that something like this is actually sensitive to a region in the history of the universe where we don't actually have a whole lot of observational constraints. So let me just give you the upshot for lambda 5 to the 4th. This set of authors said basically n has to be larger than 60 to be consistent with theta at a 3 sigma level. These authors said larger than 66 by analyzing more data. So and if you combine with the constraint I told you before, n has to be less than 62, I would say, you know, there's some tension, but perhaps not firmly well yet. But it's an interesting lesson. Data are now good enough for us to worry about n of a field. The number of people, is it 60 or 62 or 65? The data is now good enough to do that. And
the ability to say something like this is based on having assuming potential of a very definite form.
So a very definite form, yes.
And if you change phi to the fourth to phi to the alpha,
yes.
Quote, this is a bound on alpha.
Yes, you can. So if you make alpha bigger, it will more easily rule out. So mm-hmm. I would say I haven't actually done it. I would think if phi is bigger than 4, it's probably even more problematic. If phi square is fine.
May I comment on
yes, please.
So first of all, the way how we, the whole story was presented by WMAP, like we started ruling out inflationary models, which is in fact completely incorrect, because already for like last 10 years, one model after another have been ruled and many of them have been even unborn. For the simple reason that they produce deviation of the spectrum from one which is sufficiently strong. For example, many models of extended inflation were ruled out exactly because n differs from one so substantially that even early experiments would not let them go. So I think that there's something else in the reason why lambda phi to the fourth attracted such an attention. And this is the second simplest model for periodic inflation. The simple one is m squared phi squared. And m squared phi squared is doing quite well so far. Now, also, one should keep in mind that models like that, m squared phi squared, m divided by the first order, double well used. First is the idea that you can just use this, the simple power, and just explain everything. Okay. It is good for inflation in the beginning of the universe, and good for inflation at the end of inflation, and at the end of the world. And of course, it would be very optimistic to think that you just take one power and it does it all. Like if you have, for example, m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth, and then you may have m squared phi squared working at the end of inflation, because the second power is more important than the prime, then again everything will be fine. Or if you have any models of this type with large lambda, which creates you very large density perturbations, but which is good for starting inflation, and I will talk about this tomorrow, then you may have inflation started with the models like that, having made eternal due to the shape of the potential like that. And then it triggers inflation in hybrid inflation model and many other models which are better from the point of view of people who does string theory or study supersymmetric versions of inflationary models. So these kind of models could be good for description of the very beginning of inflation and then give up to the other models that would be in turn experimentally tested.
The KKLMT model, I mean, it also has a very small number of parameters, but it seems like the way it flattens out is not going.
Did you list all letters there? Because KKLMT models that doesn't describe inflation.
No, there's
KKLMM.
I mean, there you have a very definite functional form, but it flattens out. So is it amenable to this kind of bound, or is it going to test easily?
For the model like we use, there, I believe, NS was something like 0.97, and the running was very, very small. So this would just fit nicely if the model is really very realistic.
Mm-hmm.
But shouldn't we think that any of these are going to have quantum corrections and none are going to look this simple?
What?
I mean, is there any reason to believe that the potential looks like phi to the fourth or any simple form over, well, phi is any simple form of Planck's theorem?
No.
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought the point was always that it works even for this, not that this is what we should expect.
Right.
So here, you learn from that. No, it's worth ruling stuff out. It's not something that you
need to rule out.
Yes. So here is why I think the real lesson. We need better models to rule out. Okay, I think I have 5 minutes left. So let me just make a few comments about gravity waves. So this is another thing I want to emphasize, and again, probably most of you know very well already, that in the context of inflation, gravity waves are actually more robustly predicted because it doesn't really depend on the details of the potential. It's just Hilbert Planck. And so because of that, it's important to keep in mind when you build different models, as you know, what is your gravity wave predictions. In particular, if you look at the simplest inflation models, it predict this is what is known as the consistency relation. A relation between tensor to scalar ratio should be equal to the spectral index, up to some constants. And if you have a theory that actually breaks this consistency relation, that's very interesting. Because this is what the simplest models predict. And in fact, there were a lot of recent discussions about how short distance physics might actually modify the use of prediction of inflation, in addition to changing the scalar fluctuations, which you could also modify by just changing the potential. But if you actually introduce effects that break this relation, I think that's certainly very interesting. So let me end by saying that talking about just something fun that is work in progress about detection of gravity waves. So if you look at a plot of a polarization, this is a polarization map from DAISY. This is the sum map, that's the difference map. You see patterns like this. And in the last several years, there were a lot of excitement from the very simple realization that if you look at a polarization pattern, this is what I'm doing with a student, Jun Zhang. In the last several years, there were a lot of excitement because of the realization that if you look at polarization pattern, you can decompose it into two types. One is usually called the E mode, which is kind of like a gradient. The other is called B mode, which is kind of like a curl. If you think of this as vector fields, although the polarization is not really a vector because it doesn't point. And that the emo can only be given rise from basically scalar fluctuations, where the BMOs is given rise from vector or tensor fluctuations. So if you see BMOs, for example, in the polarization pattern, you know something more than scalar fluctuations is going on, and that has of course caused a lot of excitement in the community. However, we also know the following thing, which is that between the last scattering and today, there's a large-scale structure. And the large-scale structure would basically gravitationally deflect the photons. What it does, for example, if you take a pure EMO, which is something like this, you basically take each of these polarization vectors, so to speak, you displace them stochastically by large-scale structure. Without changing its orientation or magnitude, you would produce basically a mixture of E and B mode. You would take something like this, and you would get something like that, just because of lensing. And that is, of course, a worry, because then lensing introduced a fundamental limit to the detection of gravity waves. And these authors work it out that the energy scale of inflation has to be larger than 10 to 15 GeV or so for the gravity wave signal not to be confused with lensing. So, sorry. No, this actually takes into account already the fact that the lensing signal is actually dies away at large scale. So this actually takes that into account already, and this is the limit they come up with, and that's pretty large. So, it encouraged my student and I to think about ways to actually get around this, and we got some inspiration by actually going to a condensed matter physics talk, where I saw a picture like this, which is basically pneumatic liquid crystals. The polarization vector is kind of like this pneumatic liquid crystals. And of course, in condensed matter physics, people are very interested in a particular kind of topological defects in these crystals. And just to make sure you don't confuse it with cosmic defects, I call them charges, right? Topological charges, where fundamentally, you can think of it as having basically two kind of charges, minus a half and plus a half. And the way you define it is basically you go around a circle, and depending on whether it rotates clockwise or counterclockwise, you define the charge. And the fact that this is actually a half instead of an integer is just because it's not a vector. So you can rotate by pi and come back to yourself instead of 2 pi. And that's why this, and of course you can add charges and subtract things like that. Now the interesting thing to us is the fact that lensing, by basically displacing this polarization vector, they would not make the defects go away. So that's something about the map that you see that you know that is actually pre-lensing, pre-this gravitational lensing confusion. And that's interesting. And that we have a lot of fun working out, you know, what does just counting the number of these things tells you. It turns out counting these things tells you something about the combination of the E and B mode pre-lensing. I will not go into details, but at present, we are a little bit stuck because of two problems. One is that this method, by being topological, of course, doesn't distinguish between whether it's gravity wave or scalar fluctuation. So even though this is useful information, it's useful to know what is the amount of fluctuation before lensing, it doesn't quite completely get you there to the goal of, you know, really beating this bound of 10 to the 15 GeV. Another complication is kind of technical, is the fact that when you see a polarization map, what you see is basically a map, primordial fluctuation, you lens it, and then you smooth it. be smooth because of the finite instrumental resolution. And it turns out, basically, this lensing and smoothing operation, they don't commute. And so even learning something like this is actually a little bit tricky. So, but it's something we're working on. I thought it's fun to mention it here. It doesn't change the charges, but it basically introduces a confusion. It basically to relate the number density charges to what is actually in the primordial power spectrum. It involves more complicated manipulations. Basically, it doesn't directly tell you because you lens and then you smooth.
What would produce these charges?
These are basically, from the point of view of let's say, a Gaussian random fluctuations, these are just places where the polarization is zero, essentially. So you can imagine it's something very easy to calculate. You just count the number of zeros in a Gaussian random field. And I think I run out of time, so I'll stop here. Thank you. Thank you.
It was fun hearing it second time around.
Second time, yes.
It was really good.
Thank you.
That's why you, it's